posted it on the archive about a month ago. And the story, I guess several of you were probably at my IQC talk last week. And so this is kind of a follow-up on that story. What we've been coming to learn is that it's worthwhile going to the mathematical literature, the older mathematical literature on asymptotic geometric analysis, and that perhaps the way that we've learned that the way that they phrase questions might actually be the right way to, you know, from a mathematical perspective, to phrase certain questions. And the first step of that process is really to reprove things that we already knew about quantum information theory, or reinterpret them in light of, you know, this other area of mathematics. But what I'm going to tell you about today is some new results in quantum information, in which knowing about that connection was really very, very useful. And those new results, I think, are really quite surprising. Like, they're quite strong. We can do things that at least I didn't think should really be possible using quantum information. So I'll just start off by describing two tasks to you. And the objective of the talk is going to be to explain how to accomplish those two tasks. So the first task is a nice, you know, oldie but goodie. So this is just encryption. And I'm just interested in encrypting classical data in quantum states. So the situation will be that we'll have an Alice who has an X, which is a classical message, which she'll input into an encryption procedure. So that encryption procedure will take both X as an input and a classical key value. And our Bob is down here. So the quantum state that comes out of that encryption, that encryption map will be transmitted to Bob, who will then have to decode it. And Bob will have access to the key value. That's some shared secret data. But he won't obviously have access to X. He's supposed to learn X. So what's going to come out here is X. So just to set things up, we're going to say that I'll use capital X for the random variable associated to, you know, this message little x. So just say it's uniformly distributed on n-bit strings. So, you know, i.e., the probability that big X equals little x is 1 over 2 to the n. Right? And then the key is also a random variable, uniformly distributed on, say, s-bit strings, s for secret. So this is the message, and this is the secret key. OK. This is an old problem. You all know it very well. If we want perfect security here, so at least here I'm just going to assume that the decryption is perfect, right? So perfection means perfect security. Well, what does that mean? Perfect security means that any eavesdropper should always see the same thing, regardless of what the message is, right? So for any messages x1 and x2, the eavesdropper's view should be the same. So I can write that as saying the eavesdropper, who doesn't know the key value, so she has to average over the different keys. So we take the expectation value over the key values of the encryption, should be the same regardless of whether the message is x1 or if the message is x2. Right? Fair enough. Well, it was proved by Shannon ages ago, and it's been known, well, in quantum information theory since sometime in the 1990s, I guess, that if you're going to require this, then you're going to have that secret key is equal to, the length of the secret key has to be equal to the length of the message. There's not much that you can do there. So today, you know, my task number one, first I'm just going to relax the security criterion a little bit. So I'll say perfect. I'll use the term imperfect. I mean, imperfection could mean many things, but I'm going to mean imperfect in a particular way. So how could we think, you know, how could we relax the security definition? Well, we could think instead about
what an eavesdropper, in the spirit of Tsuyoshi's talk actually earlier this week, how much information could an eavesdropper extract? So we could think about maybe for all eavesdropper POVMs, so let's just write that as script M with POVM elements M sub I. So there's an eavesdropper POVM. Measuring that POVM shouldn't reveal much. So we can we know, of course, that given the POVM, the probability of getting outcome I given message X, right? Or should I write that way? We all know how to calculate that. We just have to take the trace of the ith POVM element against the appropriate quantum state. And the appropriate quantum state here, because we're not conditioning on the value of the key, this is what an eavesdropper would see, is just one of these guys. So it's just the trace of M sub I expectation over the keys encryption of message X with key value K. Right, so that's just the standard Born rule in quantum mechanics. So once we have this conditional probability, and we have a distribution over messages, we have the joint distribution of messages and outcomes, right? For a particular POVM, like that, we have a joint distribution, and so we can calculate the other conditional distribution, the distribution of X given a particular outcome. Right, because that's really what we want to control. An eavesdropper, if an eavesdropper measures, we want to make sure that that process doesn't reveal a lot of information about the message. And one way of expressing that is that if we look at the eavesdropper's posterior distribution for the message given an outcome, it should be close to what the eavesdropper had before actually performing the measurement. Right? So what we require is something pretty strong, which is just that the probability of seeing message X, or of the probability of message X, given that the outcome was a particular I, should be close to what it was before in the total variation distance, right? Norm of statistical distinguishability. So that should be smaller than epsilon. So again, this is in the spirit of what Tsuyoshi was telling you about on Tuesday, but it's actually it's a stronger condition, right? Because Tsuyoshi was speaking in terms of mutual information. So this is going to imply a condition in terms of mutual information, but it says quite a bit more, right? It's not just an average condition. It's not just saying that most of the time when you look at the outcome, you don't learn very much. It actually says every time, regardless of which outcome you get, you didn't learn very much. And it places this sort of this norm bound instead of just a mutual information bound. So I should say for all measurements and for all I. So you don't have to make any assumption about what the eavesdropper did, and you don't have to make any assumption about which outcome occurred. What we're going to require is that this should also always hold. That could certainly happen, and it's good. But it turns out that we can achieve this stronger thing, and I don't know that relaxing it even further gives us much more. Maybe it does. So, since I think at least half the room, well, most of you probably already know the answer. But those of you who haven't seen this before, how much savings do you think you might get out of this? What would be realistic to expect? Smaller key. Maybe the key becomes logarithmic in the length of the message instead of proportional to the length of the message. Are there any guesses? Who thinks it could go logarithmic? Or is that too much? Who thinks that's too much to ask? Good, thank you. So who thinks logarithmic? Logarithmic in n might be a reasonable answer here. No. You're all very well informed, because the answer is actually even better. So you can prove, at least we have an existence proof, that this S, which is the length of the secret key, doesn't have to depend on the length of the message at all, right? So that this S can be just big O of log of 1 over epsilon. So that you can encrypt class, you know, you can, at least in principle, if you're satisfied with this security definition, you can encrypt classical messages with keys that are independent of the length of the message and get information theoretic security. Now, I don't want to make too strong a claim about this because this definition, which is about the outcomes of measurements, it might be difficult to compose it, to use this as a subroutine in other cryptographic protocols because of the way the definition is structured. So maybe it would be useful as a subroutine in other cryptographic protocols, maybe not, but it's not automatically composable. So there's a little, you know, there should be a little alert that maybe it looks a little bit better than it really is. But at this point, we don't actually know. But nonetheless, this is really pretty strong. So that's the existence statement. And what we also have is an actual quantum circuit. So we have a way of performing this encryption here, in which the running time is actually only slightly superlinear in the number of bits. So if you want to encrypt on a quantum computer, you can do it in almost linear time. Now, what we pay for that is that our explicit construction is not quite as good as the existential one. And there, our secret key is just a little bit bigger. So big O log N over epsilon times the log of 1 over epsilon. So we don't yet have an efficient construction, which is completely independent of the length of the message. So if you're looking for a project, you know, and you like combinatorics, and like if you're Ashwin, for example, that might be an interesting thing to work on. So that's task number one. If you're an Ashwin student, yeah, exactly. So task number two. So I'll call this sending quantum data through classical channels. Yeah, sure.
We know
it's secure if you compose it with itself, like in parallel. And I think you could make statements like if you can guarantee that various protocols sort of begin and end individually, so you only compose them sequentially, then I think maybe it would be okay. But otherwise, yeah, I don't think we don't know it to be insecure. we just don't know it to be secure.
Patrick, I think if you can have the eavesdropper or whoever wanting to know about the message, having quantum storage and can delay measuring, I think in general this is clearly insecure.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah.
By definition, I think it's the whole point is to impose that measurement.
Yeah. Yeah, so if you can't force the eavesdropper to measure, so I don't know the specific. I guess we could construct a protocol in which it would fail. Yeah. You can extend this to make it secure against small amounts of quantum storage as well. That's sort of a bit of another story.
Sorry, what is the relevance here? I mean, the eavesdropper. You mean in a case where you're composing it with some other protocol? And where is the quantum storage relevant? I mean, this is encryption, right? So the eavesdropper gets it. The question is, can the eavesdropper get information or not?
Oh, yeah, but what you can do is you can replace this security definition by one in which some large fraction of whatever the eavesdropper, like the eavesdropper has to measure everything except for a small number of qubits, and then you replace this by the trace norm for the quantum state tensored with some classical data that the eavesdropper gets. That makes sense? Because here the eavesdropper has to convert everything that she receives into classical data. But you could just say that the eavesdropper converts everything she receives in minus k qubits, or well, like e qubits or something, into classical data.
Sorry, but she's just receiving it in one big block.
Yeah.
So, I mean, so again, so if you're just looking at this protocol in isolation, why does it matter whether she converts
at all? No, the whole point is to not look at it in isolation. The whole point
So if it's so if you're putting it into a bigger protocol.
Right.
So if
X is the key that you want to distribute, then you're out of luck. Because you still have to use the key some of the time, and you can't really analyze a protocol on its own.
Right, sure. I mean,
But for the longer, for the combined thing, you'd have another protocol, is that right? That would be equally good.
But the point is that if you use this method to say that there's very little information on X, and then you try to compose it with something else that requires very little information on X, therefore you get some other conclusion, then the joint attack on the two protocols together may be stronger than the two analyses separate. So the question is, can we just analyze individual protocols and put them together in general? And this kind of analysis may not...
It's a bit of just a distressing feature of the whole field of cryptography. If they're independent of each other, that's fine. There's no issue. But an example would be that maybe the message here, maybe what you want to use this for, think of X as being a secret key. And so you want to have a very small secret key that you expand to a really long secret key, right? Like Alice and Bob, they start off with a small secret key K, and they'd like to share a very, very large secret key. So Alice could just choose a random number in her lab, and that's X, and then encrypt it using this protocol, and then Bob receives it, and then they both share X. And then you might want to use that secret key for some other, as a starting point for some other cryptographic protocol. And the issue is that we can't guarantee security if you're going to compose things that way from this definition. But the secret key that this exactly. So this if you just use this in isolation, it's okay. But as part of a larger cryptographic infrastructure, it could be problematic. Because basically, in that setting, you couldn't guarantee that Bob's message would be uniform from the eavesdropper's point of view. So again, you can relax that assumption as well. This uniformity, you can replace it with some min entropy assumption on the message. Right. No. So again, it doesn't follow from this, but the paper does things in a slightly more sophisticated way, and that scenario would be okay. That basically, if you run two of these in parallel or sequentially, it's as good as running one big one. So then all you need to worry about is the fact that the messages are no longer uniform, and that causes your key to grow a little bit. Yeah.
Then they would be able to answer questions and communicate back and forth.
I mean, Piper says it in the paper that counts, but it doesn't immediately follow from this.
No, right.
Yeah.
But these loopholes don't seem, I'm just trying to understand, these loopholes are just kind
the,
of...
The loopholes are...
Things, or are they really...
The loopholes are really things you should be concerned about if you're a real cryptographer.
That's the question.
But I should perhaps move ahead, if I'm to let you out. But we can discuss it further afterwards. Okay, so second task. And the title, don't take the title too seriously, because obviously it can't be done. So now we have our Alice again. And her goal, this is a quantum task. So she has n qubits, and they're real qubits. There's no, this is a physical quantum system of n qubits that she has in her lab. And somehow she wants to get this to Bob in some sense, right? So she's going to perform, say, a measurement, which I call F,
And out of that measurement comes classical data. So the way that I indicate the classical data is this: these double lines. And from that classical data, he'll do something called, say, recovery, and out comes phi. Right? This is ideally what we'd like to do, and we'll say that that's maybe n classical bits. And obviously, this is impossible, right? It can't be done. Because if Alice doesn't know what this quantum state is, any measurement damages the state, and you can't get a perfect recovery at the end, and so on and so forth, right? But we also all know that there are interesting senses in which you can sort of send quantum information using classical bits. One of them being teleportation, right? If we had some e-bits here, you can replace the quantum channel by n e-bits, and then actually succeed at the task that I've just described. But I want to do something else. Is anyone out there? So I'm going to supplement the classical channel by a quantum channel. So that's q qubits. Okay. So if we're to succeed at this task perfectly, how large does q need to be? N, yes. Okay, so we need that q is larger than or equal to n, and m is irrelevant, right? So whether you have those classical bits or not is really immaterial, because you just send all the quantum data through the quantum bits. So let's alter the task. So, okay, we're done with our, you know, if our goal is to send quantum data through classical channels, we've failed because we sent it all through a quantum channel. So let's slightly modify our task. So instead of having a quantum recovery, we're going to have a test. So we're going to have a measurement here, which I'll call m psi. And there's one for every quantum state psi. And what it is, it's a test that's supposed to tell you, so the output is classical. And it's supposed to tell you, is the state that Alice sent psi, right? Is that the state that Alice had in her lab? So if Bob actually performed this test, he would get the answer yes with probability inner product between phi and psi squared, right? So that's what should happen, and he'd get the answer no with probability 1 minus the inner product. Right, so this is a way of just testing whether or not the transmitted state was the one that it was supposed to be. Okay, so I repeat the question. If we're to do this perfectly, how large does Q need to be? Everything's still correct, is the answer. That this task is totally equivalent to actually transmitting the full quantum state from Alice to Bob. Because what it basically means is that if you can perform these measurements, which are basically, they're tests, right? You have a rank one projector and a projector onto the orthogonal complement. That's what these measurements look like. And if you can do all of those perfectly, then you can do any projective measurement perfectly just by building them up out of rank one tests. And so, again, nothing interesting happens. Yeah.
There is the recovery channel. So isn't what is arriving there an m-qubit state instead of m-qubit?
So the state that Alice has in her lab is a state of n-qubits. And then there's some instrument here that has a classical output and a quantum output. Let's say the quantum output is q-qubits for q, which is a parameter. And the classical part is m classical bits that come out. And then Bob receives both of these things, the classical bits and the quantum bits. And at that point, you can think of that just as a quantum state, right, with a classical part and a quantum. So he performs a measurement on that whole thing, which otherwise put is that conditioned on the classical message, he performs a measurement of the quantum thing.
But the question is, this state wouldn't be on a different Hilbert space than what we expect it to be.
Oh, so psi is in the same space. Sorry. So, so if this is not, m is not equal to zero and q equal to n, then there has to be this measurement psi is not just it's some kind of simulation of the ideal measurement, right? Because we know what the ideal measurement is, like we know what the ideal m sub psi is, but we don't necessarily know how to implement it using these resources. So that's really the question, yeah. So the imperfect version. Well, what's a natural way to make this imperfect? We'll just throw in a little fudge factor. Right? You can get the inner product off. You know, you can be off by a little bit in the inner product. And again, we get some quite remarkable savings, just like we did over here. So specifically, we can get Q is big O of log of 1 over epsilon. So the amount of quantum data that's required to actually succeed at this task, even though the perfect version of it is just as strong as being able to send the quantum data, is now independent of the amount of quantum data you're trying to, or of the size of the quantum state that Alice has in her lab. So you can just send a constant size quantum system independent of n. And the number of classical bits is actually smaller, but roughly the same as the number of quantum bits that Alice started with. So you send a number of classical bits, which is more or less one classical bit per qubit of the input, and then you send a tiny, 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 tiny number of quantum bits. And you can nonetheless actually perform this test properly for any psi, for any input state, or rather for any pair. So Bob can perform this measurement, which is independent of what Alice had in her lab, and it will correctly produce the statistics. So Bob can perform
the encoding that Alice does is independent of the state psi that Bob is going to measure.
Yes, definitely. Okay. Yeah. Then otherwise it would be very easy.
Yeah.
Do you have any idea sort of what the coefficient in front is and how large n has to be?
I do. Or at least I can work it out. Like in our paper we have the constants. These numbers, they don't have to be that big. But off the top of my head, I couldn't tell you exactly. Because basically what matters is that the dimension be large for these things to work. And when you're talking qubits, the dimension gets large very quickly. So I could check the numbers, but I suspect that even up at n on the order of 10 or 15, you get interesting effects.
Coefficient in front is order unity or not a huge number?
Oh, right here?
Yeah.
Yeah, order unity. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So the probability in the end does not depend on the initial probability distribution that Alice chooses for her phi, right?
Yeah, in fact, it's adversarial. There is no distribution over phi.
Right. So it's saying for every given phi, yeah, this has to work.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. So I can just say for all phi. And so again, similar statement, if we're going to do this on a quantum computer. Q can be big O of log of n over epsilon times log of 1 over epsilon. And what I mean by efficient now is that the thing that Alice needs to do is efficient. There's a bit of a question of what it means for Bob's simulation to be efficient, because he has to choose a quantum state psi. And writing down a classical description of the state that he's chosen, this is an n qubit state, so it takes an exponential amount of time. But his quantum circuit is actually tiny. But he might have an enormous amount of classical pre-computation to do in order to for that to work. Okay. So that's the motivation. And where does this come from? So this is like this is now the how. And I'll just introduce a little bit of notation, because I'm going to use this a lot. So I'll write P sub omega A. So this is going to be a probability vector. So the trace of, if we have an orthonormal basis for our A system, we measure that orthonormal basis. And it's bipartite on two systems A and B, which you shouldn't interpret as Alice and Bob here, necessarily. And I'll use d sub a to denote the dimension of a. So it's just the vector of probabilities that you would get if you measured omega, which is a state of a tensor b, in an orthonormal basis on the a system. And just another little notation. So I'll use that notation for the set. So the key objects in all of this are something that we're calling metric uncertainty relations. And these are going to really be honest-to-goodness uncertainty relations in the spirit of Heisenberg uncertainty relations, entropic uncertainty relations, and so on, but in some sense stronger. So we can derive other uncertainty relations from these. So a set of unitaries U0, U1, up to UT minus 1. So we have two different unitaries. So you should think of these just as T orthonormal bases for a space. We say they satisfy a metric uncertainty relation. So if, on average, over the different choices of unitaries, right? So on average, if we look at the distribution that we would get if we measured a state psi rotated, in the computational basis of A, but we rotated the whole thing by UK. Okay? This should be close to uniform. And that's for all psi. Okay? So let's take a moment to parse the definition, because this is what we're going to use over and over again. So we have a state psi, and that state psi lives in a tensor product space. It lives in A tensor B. Okay, and we have a set of unitaries. So we can take that state psi, and we can rotate it by one of t different unitaries. And the statement is just that once you've typically, when if you just choose k at random and apply u to your psi, and then you measure in the orthonormal basis of the A system, then you get something that just looks flat. It just looks like noise. But it's totally uninformative. Okay, so that's the definition of metric uncertainty relation. And among other things, it implies, so because this distribution is close to uniform, it has high entropy, right? So if you're familiar with entropic uncertainty relations, it implies immediately that the average entropy of measurement, is large. Right? So if we look at this is the Shannon entropy of that probability vector. So if we look at the average Shannon entropy of these probability vectors, then it's close to the largest that it could possibly be, because these probability vectors are close to uniform. So this function, this eta, is just some function of epsilon that goes to zero with epsilon and is independent of the dimension. So in particular, if you can get the B system to be very small, then this is a really strong entropic uncertainty relation. And it's in particular, the paper demonstrates the existence of entropic uncertainty relations for sets of sort of much stronger than it previously known to exist. So the existence statement that we have, and these proofs are, I won't get into the proof of the existence statement, because it's totally standard stuff by now for many of you. I'll say what I mean by this in a second. So the existence, we can get the dimension of B
is big O of 1 over epsilon squared, right? So the dimension of B is independent of this sort of, in some sense, how big you want your systems to be. And then, well, I guess both of them are. And then the number of unitaries you need is log of 1 over epsilon squared. So when I say, how do you do this a la Dvoretsky, all you have to do is you choose these unitaries at random according to the Haar measure, you discretize the set of possible size, and then you do some union bounds and so on. So there are lots of papers in quantum information that have arguments essentially of this type. But somehow, previous attempts to get at uncertainty relations using these methods didn't give as good parameters, basically because entropies and mutual information things are hard to work with. They're really ugly functions. But working with norms is, you know, just much more natural, actually, that you don't lose as much in the analysis. And so just basically by virtue of working with this definition rather than with the entropic uncertainty relations to start with, it's actually pretty easy to prove this. Like, I wouldn't say there's any, you know, there's not much innovation there. But that's all we need in order to accomplish these tasks. Now, it might not be, it's probably not at all obvious to you, right, that this weird metric uncertainty relation thing could be useful for any, you know, like it looks like a bit of a weird definition, right, because in particular, it has this bipartite structure. And the task that we've been describing here, the inputs don't seem to have any natural bipartite structure. So let's just see how the connection, where the connection comes from. Are there questions about the definition and the existence statement, I guess? No? Okay. So, so the connection here is just that this X, this is what we have to figure out how to build, right? We have to figure out how to build this thing. And all it is, X comes in on the A system, and then you just throw in some noise on the B system. So it's not secret key, but they're secret bits, but they're secret to Alice alone. So Bob doesn't need to know them in the encryption process. So it's a little bit of seed secrecy, but not shared secrecy. So Alice can just generate this in her own laboratory. And then UK Dagger. And so the encryption, it slightly blows up the message. Right, so what is actually transmitted is these two wires, and so the original message is blown up by this little, you know, you have to add some ancilla, which is the B system, and we can ask, well, how much ancilla do you have to add? Well, it's the log of the dimension of the B system, right? So it's a constant amount; it's independent of n. It depends only on epsilon. So you just have to tag on a little bit. So this is really not a very worrisome blow up. Now, why does this have anything to do with encryption? Like, what is the connection here? And I'm not going to do the calculation because the calculation is actually just an identity. So the thing that we're interested in is this problem. So if the POVM that the eavesdropper performs is rank 1, right, so if it has that form for normalized states psi I, like, again, we're interested in bounding the information that an eavesdropper can extract. So if an eavesdropper was performing some POVM in which the operators had higher rank, she could always refine it further and only get more information out of it. So without loss of generality, we can talk about POVMs that are rank 1. Then in that case, this quantity that we're interested in, and this is a calculation that I encourage you to try at home because it's just an identity. We're interested in this quantity. It's just equal to the following. So if you sit down and just write out the definitions, right, we know how to, you know how to calculate this quantity exactly. simple manipulations get you straight to this point here. And so what we really care about is somehow the average probability vector for a given psi i, where we average over the different values of k. But if we look at the definition of metric uncertainty relation, it actually guarantees something even stronger, right, by the triangle inequality. So just by the definition of metric uncertainty relation, this is smaller than epsilon. And that's the whole proof that this thing works, is that you just have to notice that this identity holds. Well, that's simple enough. This one's a little bit more complicated, if we want to see how to build this this method. Are there questions about the encryption? Okay. So what we have to do here is, so Alice has is going to prepare some ancilla. So instead of using these key values as choosing one of these key values according to a classical probability distribution, he actually prepares a superposition of key values, of k values. And conditioned on those, she's going to apply over here it turned out it was u sub k dagger, but she's going to apply u sub k. So the quantum state that comes in is, we can just think of it as being a quantum state of the A tensor B system. And U has two wires coming out, right? An A wire and a B wire. Let's just call this one the B wire and this one the A wire. So that's how you're actually going to use these unitaries. Now, given this thing, we somehow have to convert the output of this into some classical data, right? Because that's what actually has to be transmitted. So let's convert the A system into classical data. So there's the circuit. So here's our quantum. So this is Q. How many qubits do we have? Well, we have log T plus the log of the dimension of dB. And we know from over here that number is basically its order the log of 1 over epsilon. And then this thing here, this is m, is equal to log dA, is approximately n classical bits. That's qubits. And that's the construction. That's how you do this transmission. Now, it's probably kind of mysterious to you that this thing should work, right? I just sort of randomly written down some funny circuit. So here's I'll give you the reasoning. Let's just throw that away. I'm unthrowing away the garbage, yes. that goes there. So what observations do we make? So first note, so if we think about the M metric uncertainty relation, so by the definition of a metric uncertainty relation, if we measure the A system, the output is largely independent of the choice of state phi. Right? But that is precisely what this condition says. That if we apply a random U sub k, then typically we get an output which is very close to uniform. Right? And so by the metric uncertainty relation, or y, right? Because a and y are the same, is almost independent of phi. Right? So the, whatever sort of information is coming into the system, it's, if you only look at A, you don't learn anything about it. Right? You perform, if you were to perform a measurement of A, you just get an almost uniform distribution. Now, this should hopefully remind you a little bit of a, you know, one of the core observations of quantum information theory, that if you have a... So here we can think of a quantum channel from AB to a, say, to Y, right? So we have two quantum channels, two complementary channels. We have the channel from AB to, I guess I should give this a name, C, to ABC. And we have the channel from AB, oh, it has a name, X, and AB to Y, right? So we know that this channel from AB to Y just forgets the input, right? So in some sense, it's almost the constant channel. Now, if you know your quantum error correction, what that should make you think is, well, if the channel from AB to Y is constant, then the complementary channel should be correctable, because all the quantum information somehow has to go over here, right? But there's a catch, which is that I've only told you that this channel is constant in a weak sense, right? I haven't told you that it destroys entanglement with a reference system, which is the usual way we think of it in quantum information theory. All I've said is for a fixed for a quantum state which is pure on the input space, the output is largely independent of the input. And it turns out this is a strictly weaker notion, but it has a complementary condition analogous to quantum error correction. So the theorem is called the fidelity alternative, or we called it that. So this is a paper with Andreas Winter earlier this year. So the channel from AB to X must preserve fidelities. So if you have a phi 1 and a phi 2 at the input, then if you look at the mixed state fidelity for the X system, then that mixed state fidelity, even though it's a very mixed state here, should be close to the input mixed state fidelity. And it actually also implies, I just have to leave it at that, task 2. So if you have a channel from AB to Y, which is almost constant in this weak sense, then the replacement for quantum error correction for the complementary channel is precisely what I've told you right here. So that's what happens. Are there questions about the intuition? Okay. So I guess this is the existence statement. I should perhaps have also written the efficient construction. I have to. Maybe I shouldn't have. Yeah. Okay, so the title of the talk begins with low distortion embeddings. And I haven't mentioned low distortion embeddings at all yet. So now I'd like to tell you about what the connection to low distortion embeddings actually is. Because all of this, what's actually getting all this to work is some intuition that comes from geometry. Now, the metric uncertainty relation, I've expressed it there in terms of the trace distance, but I could have used the fidelity instead, right? Like, we all know those are more or less equivalent. So I could write my metric uncertainty relation as saying that the average of the mixed state fidelity between this p uk psi on A and uniform should be close to 1. Right, and I just have to replace the original epsilon by some function delta of epsilon, and I can do that. All right, so this is more or less, at least morally, an equivalent way of expressing the metric uncertainty relation. But let's just unpack this a little bit, right? Like unpack what this is actually saying. So if we take, say, just the fidelity between some p of A sub omega, or some arbitrary state omega, and the uniform distribution. And what's that equal to? Well, we have to take the sum this is a probability vector on the A space, right? So it has capital, or it has d sub A, different terms. We'll say from 0 to dA minus 1 of the square root. And we just have to take the coefficients from this thing. So the trace and B right, so we just take that right from the definition of p sub omega A, and we plug in 1 over dA, because that's what the uniform distribution contains. So that's what this fidelity is, right? And we can re-express it just by expanding the identity matrix as a sum of projectors, orthonormal projectors. So sum over A and then another sum over B. Now, right? I think everyone here who does quantum mechanics is familiar with these kinds of things, right? That I could just expand this identity matrix as the sum of these of the projectors onto B, and then when I take the trace, I get exactly this expression. Oh, and yeah, thanks. Sorry? Oh, you. Yeah. Is that okay? So we can just call this thing, give this thing a name now. So we'll call this 1 over the square root of dA. And well, this actually already has a name, is more the point. It's a particular norm of this vector omega. And that norm is called the L1 of A, L2 of B norm. So why is that? Well, omega is a state on A tensor B, right? So we can just think of it's if we expand it in terms of this AB basis, it's just a matrix of coefficients. So we could first take the L2, right, as the Euclidean norm of the columns, and then take the L1 norm of those Euclidean norms, which is just their sum, right? So another way of writing exactly the same thing now is that this omega, that this L1 of L2 norm of omega, well, is the fidelity. And I guess I'll go right here. I have to let you go soon. I guess we chatted a bit too much. But the metric uncertainty relation becomes the following, right? 1 minus delta.
Faithful to the uniform.
Oh, so, sorry. Yeah, this quantity here?
Yeah. It's faithful to something else, right? So the uniform distribution in this case?
There's a comma in there. I don't know if you can see.
So
So yeah. It has this formula.
But there's a sort of a whole story there that if you want to write down a function that extends the absolute value of the inner product from pure states to mixed states, then this is really this is the function that you should be using. And so in particular, in this case, we have two probability distributions. So this formula becomes the sum of the square roots of the products of the coefficients. Oh. So it's just a measure of proximity. So we're measuring the proximity of this probability vector to the uniform. Yeah. Yep.
It's relative to the uniform.
Well, it does because I've chosen to insert the uniform as the other thing we compare to. Yeah. So 1-1 is delta. I guess we wrote this down, right? Right here. So it's smaller than 1 over t times the sum k equals 0 t minus 1, 1 over the square root of dA, and now it's uk psi. And that's for all psi. Right, so this is just a change of notation now. But this is where things get interesting. So I say for all psi, and that's sort of implicitly I'm talking about normalized psi, because we're talking about quantum states. But now let's not restrict ourselves to talking about normalized vectors. So, I'm just going to make myself a bit of space here. I could say 1 minus delta times the Euclidean norm of psi. Right? And then because everything's homogeneous, this inequality holds really for all psi, right? For all possible vectors. And I could rewrite this thing just as 1 over the square root of t times dA and 1 over the square root of t, sum from k equals 0 to t minus 1, uk psi, that's ab, k on, let's call it c. L1 of AC, L2 of B. So here, I'm just taking a sum of a bunch of norms, right? That is, I'm taking the L1 norm of a bunch of norms. So I can just absorb it. I could just say, okay, well, let's actually just join an extra system here and say we're taking the L1 A of A and C of L2 of B. And that's just, again, by sort of the definition of these L1 and L2 norms, the same thing. And it's an easy little Cauchy-Schwarz inequality, Cauchy-Schwarz, that this is less than or equal to the L2 norm of psi. Because basically, I have an L1 norm on AC, and if you're familiar with those kinds of things, I'm going to pick up the square root of the dimension of A times the square root of the dimension of C, which cancels this. So, why did I do all of this? Now we can interpret this metric uncertainty relation in a very natural geometric way. Because what it's saying is that if I measure the norm of psi using the Euclidean norm, I get up to some scale factor, which doesn't matter, right? If I multiply norm by, if I take the Euclidean norm and multiply it by 7, it's still the same geometry, right? It's still the Euclidean norm. So up to this little fudge factor of 1 minus delta, the Euclidean norm and this funny L1 AC of L2 of B norm are the same, right? So this weird geometry of L1 of AC, L2 of B is actually behaving in an almost Euclidean way for this set of states. And I can make, I can make a sort of more formal statement there, which is that the map psi AB to one over square root of t, sum over k, u sub k psi k, a b c, is a low distortion in embedding. Of AB into, or rather, L2 of AB into L1 of AC, L2 of B. Now, it turns out that this metric uncertainty condition is a little bit stronger, right? That it's not quite enough to just ask for one of these low distortion embeddings. That I could go from metric uncertainty relation to low distortion, but I couldn't quite go the other way around. But they're very, very closely related, and I'll give you an option to exit because somehow things went a little bit more slowly than I hoped. But this is what actually allows us to construct explicit quantum circuits, because it turns out that in classical computer science, people really care about embedding L2 spaces into L1 spaces. And just back in 2006, Piotr Indyk found a construction on the for embedding L2 spaces into L1 of L2 spaces as sort of a step along the way to getting all the way to L1. And so he would do this recursively, shrinking the L2 part until it eventually disappeared. And so the quantum circuits that we get by adapting an explicit construction that people were using in classical computer science already. Explicit circuits by modifying Indyk 2006, which is L2. Into L1 and L2. So I'll just, because I'm over time, I'll just say that anyone who feels that they'd like to head out, I'm not going to be offended, so you have a chance now to just scoot away. while I search for more talk. But those of you who are staying, I'll explain to you quickly how this construction works. So, the ingredients.
So I have a question, Patrick.
Okay.
Should we tell the people who already left that you are offended?
I was thinking of the same question.
Yes.
It's really a pretty simple thing. So the first ingredient is just, I'll leave a little blank here, but mutually unbiased bases. So, in the form of unitaries, taking, say, the computational basis to the different bases of the mutually unbiased basis. So, V0 up to V sub r minus 1, satisfying x, Vi dagger, Vj, y. So I think you all know what mutually unbiased bases are. So in the original construction, he just used mutually unbiased bases. It turns out that your parameters don't get much worse if you use, call them gamma approximate mutually unbiased bases. So what I mean by gamma approximate, we just allow ourselves a gamma in there. And if you're interested, for example, in gamma, so the case of gamma equals 1 is an actual mutually unbiased basis. Gamma 1 half minus some small can be done using only Hadamards. So if you're interested in actually implementing this stuff, there's some advantage using current technology. Then there's some advantage in moving away from mutually unbiased bases to gamma approximate mutually unbiased bases. So that's ingredient one. And ingredient two, again, has some blank spots, but the key thing, and this is this is the only property that was really used in index original construction, but for our purposes, we're going to need some additional properties. You need an extractor. So an extractor is just a classical function, or a set of functions, really. So it's a purely classical object. And for those of you who don't know what it is, I'll just explain it very quickly. So you need some seed, which is uniform. I'll just draw it as a quantum circuit. And let's say that the value, this is a classical circuit. So there's some value here, which is y. And there's going to be some function p of y. And it's going to act on a bunch of bits. So let's call this x. Let's say this is n bits. And the condition on those bits is that they have some randomness in them, right? So there's an entropy function called the min entropy. Its specific definition isn't that important. It's somehow a little bit more stringent in measuring randomness than the Shannon entropy is. But all we know about these random bits is that, about these bits is that there's some randomness in them, right? But it's not uniform. Like, we just have a promise that there's some randomness there. And so what we'd like to do is concentrate it all in one place and make it uniform. So that's what an extractor does. It extracts the randomness. So it produces approximately m, approximately uniform bits. Okay. So these were the ingredients for index construction. Now we're going to want to implement this on a quantum computer, and we're also going to want to do something a little bit stronger than what he was doing. We want these metric uncertainty relations. So it turns out that we need not just this condition that I've written down, that the output should be approximately uniform, but we need what's called a strong extractor. And what strong means is that if you look at the output of the seed and those m bits, they're jointly almost uniform. So that's one condition. We're going to want to implement this permutation on a quantum computer, which means that if we adjoin, that we want it to be a permutation, right? Because it has to be a classical function that we can implement on a quantum computer. So p of y should be a permutation. That's what's called a permutation extractor. And we really want to be able to implement this p of y as a unitary, right? And that's not guaranteed. That in order to implement this p of y as a unitary on a quantum computer, we're going to have to uncompute some junk. And in order to do that, we actually need that p of y be efficiently invertible. So this is where a fair amount of the work in the paper came from, is that we had to construct extractors with these three properties in order to get the whole thing to work. But once you have that, putting them together is pretty easy. And then I'll let you go. I'll let you go. And then I'll give you a quick, I can tell you a little bit about the connection to quantum hiding fingerprints. So the construction is just the following. So the key, or this k, which is a random number that we choose, the first thing we choose at random is an index for one of the mutually unbiased bases. Okay? So imagine that you had a quantum state coming in, and then a mutually unbiased, or a transformation to one of a number of different mutually unbiased bases gets performed, and you don't know which one. And then you just measure in the computational basis. What can you say? I mean, it's not too hard to prove that there's going to be some amount of randomness there, right? That you can't always get exactly the same outcome because you mapped your input psi to a bunch of different mutually unbiased spaces. So you can prove some lower bound on how much entropy there is here, right? So if you've proved a lower bound on how much entropy there is, you could then use an extractor to pull out that entropy. But then the extractor also has other stuff that you don't know how to deal with. So you just recurse. You apply another mutually unbiased basis, and another extractor, and you get at some more good random bits. And then you just keep on doing this until you're done. And so the K is just going to be the concatenation of all these random choices that you made along the way. And everything is really designed to ensure, and it's not too hard, it really isn't all that hard to prove, that if you have these conditions, that the metric uncertainty relation condition will follow. And I guess just before you leave, the last thing that I'll say is just that this is not such a, you know, a lot of the stuff that we do, and especially the stuff that I do, I guess, the vast majority of the stuff that I do is really science fiction, right? It needs a quantum computer to be implemented. That's not actually true of all of this. Because as I mentioned to you before, we can get by with these gamma approximate mutually unbiased bases, right? Which means that these Vs are really just applications of some Hadamards. That's not super crazy. And observe that at least if we want to do this encryption, we don't apply UK, but we apply UK dagger. So if we were satisfied with only doing the first step of this recursive construction, we first apply a permutation, and then we apply the Hadamards. But the input for the encryption is classical. So the permutation is just a classical computation on some classical bits. And so the bottom line is you can, even just using one step of this construction, you can get some quite interesting encryption procedures for classical bits that are not so far away from being, that really could be implemented probably in the laboratory, subject to some issues with detector efficiency. Now, I'll really let you go but I'll just let you know one last thing to connect to Tsuyoshi's talk on Tuesday. He gave us a really beautiful talk about this idea of quantum hiding fingerprints. And this encryption procedure actually gives you an alternative way of achieving what Tsuyoshi was talking about. Because if you just take a method of doing classical fingerprints, and then you encrypt them using this procedure, subject to a little bit of extra condition that I don't want to get into, then you get quantum hiding fingerprints with good parameters. And the funny thing is that because you need some extra conditions, so the explicit construction we have here doesn't work. But because the fingerprints are so small, even the random selection of hard unitaries can be done efficiently with just a polynomial amount of random bits. And so you achieve, I think, with worse parameters than what Tsuyoshi has, but still sort of, at least in principle, efficient quantum hiding fingerprints using the random UK construction of metric uncertainty relations. So I'm sorry for keeping you longer, but that's all I wanted to tell you. And
thanks for your attention.